I think true entrepreneurs, you'll see, at least from the ones that, you know, I've met that are really successful, you know, you've been selling baseball cards since you were a kid.
So hi everyone, welcome back to the podcast. So super stoked to announce that we have Andrew Riestecki, who's a legend on Twitter, or X as it's now known. So Andrew, I love what you build with Acquire, and I know you opened up, so let's get right into it. And so I know you opened up a bit of, about growing up poor, and you made a post about how your dad passed away. So how did these experiences kind of shape you into who you are today, into the entrepreneur that you are today? And like, what did living on food stamps and such, like, how did that help you to become a better entrepreneur or just to get started in the entrepreneurial space?
Oh, wow. We're starting like that. Well, first, thank you so much, Ruby, for having me on the podcast. Like I was saying before we started recording, I admire your persistence. But to answer your question, growing up wasn't as easy for most people, but also the way I kind of view it is people also have it harder. So with that sort of perspective, you know, I always view things in a positive light, I guess, you know, so, you know, in one way I could feel sorry for myself. But I decided, you know, hey, this is an opportunity for me to, you know, view the world differently. And this is an opportunity for me to, you know, really shape who I am. And obviously I think about my dad often, and I barely know anything about him. I guess another short answer to your question is it wasn't fun, but it definitely builds, you know, grit and character, and you have to figure things out on your own in life. And I think I learned that early at a young age.
So in the absence of your father's death, like, who were those kind of father figures that you looked up to? Like, anybody that comes top of the mind in the startup space or just in your personal life? Like, anybody that you could share today? And how did they have an impact on your life?
Great question. In terms of father figures, unfortunately, I never really had one growing up. I had some really good teachers in elementary school. One was Mr. James. He noticed very early on I was really good at chess. And then also computers too. He had a classroom full of Macs, and this is in fourth grade, so this was 30 years ago. No, not 30. I'm not that old. I'm 34. Fourth grade is, I don't know, you're 8, 9, 10. So 25 years ago, I hope he bought some Apple stock, because he had like 10 Apple computers in his room. And then he'd also let us play chess. And I think those two things really helped in terms of, you know, chess is great with just business strategy, in terms of, you know, you always want to think every move you make, you want to try to think 10 moves out, or at least that's how I view things. And then just having access to computers at such a young age when I didn't have one at home was pretty awesome. And then moving forward along in my career, I got really lucky. When I went to college, I went to CSU Chico State. And two people, Peter Strauss and this individual, Christian Friedland. Peter Strauss was the head of the entrepreneurship program at Chico State. And I won fourth, third, second, and then finally first in the business plan competition. I'd enter every year. And I'd write these big emails every time I lost, saying like one year I lost to someone that had an idea to put like tracker chips and like children. And I write an email like, the regulatory stuff and the capital requirements, like, how the heck did this beat my idea? And so he kind of took me under his wing and helped me, you know, or at least motivated me to start my first business. And then actually introduced me to the second person, Christian Friedland, who built a company called Build.com. It's essentially Home Depot or Lowe's online. They do, I think, north of $5 billion in GMV per year. And he became a small angel investor in my first company, and was probably the best mentor I could have ever asked for. So there's many other people I'm forgetting. Tim Porthouse, my CEO coach, There's too many to mention, but those are the ones that come to mind.
I think that's really great that you had so many people who had their belief capital in you and who were like mentors to you, kind of. So you shared a bit with Paul Elijahs on his podcast, but what are the nitty-gritties behind starting a startup in college? And what is your advice on securing belief capital as a young founder, as a college founder? Like, what could you share on that front?
What do you mean by belief capital?
Belief capital in the sense like somebody like believes in you and like they put their capital or like their trust in you, kind of. Something like that. That's kind of like what I was envisioning for the belief capital.
Gotcha. So, I mean, that could come from, you know, your customers, it can come from your friends, it can come from investors. Ideally, it's, you know, coming from customers first, or I'd say yourself first. I always say, you know, you got to believe in yourself, otherwise no one else will. So it starts with yourself, and then obviously, you know, customers are the ultimate litmus test in terms of, you know, are you delivering a service they'll pay for? Did you build a product that solves a problem for them? And you're asking specifically how do you get this in college? You know, I kind of have, you know, some thoughts on, you know, certain entrepreneurs, and this is probably like a debate, but I'm not really sure entrepreneurship can truly be learned. I think for some today, entrepreneurship is viewed as kind of the cool thing to do and go after it. But for me, it was, I like to kind of frame it as it was a survival mechanism. It was, you know, a path out of a life that, you know, I didn't want for my family and my children. And so when you build a business, things get hard and they get challenging. And that's when a lot of people give up. And to me, those are people that are not necessarily true entrepreneurs. And we've seen a wave of those. And I think that's great. But I think true entrepreneurs, you'll see, at least from the ones that, you know, I've met that are really successful. You know, you've been selling baseball cards since you were a kid. You had an eBay store before you were even legally allowed to. So I think it needs to start at a young age, but, if I had to give an answer to that, you know, I would say, you know, just believe in yourself and, you know, look at other people who have been in your situation and found a way to make it work. And that's kind of what I did. So when I was trying to figure out, you know, I didn't have any capital, so I couldn't go into real estate. I knew I wanted to start a business because candidly, just had a goal of creating wealth for my family. And so I kind of looked at the ways to do that and I landed on, okay, I need to build an asset so I can one day sell that asset, but I can't buy assets. So I need to build one. Okay, so what's an asset I can build with low barriers to entry? And that's where I kind of really fell in love with technology and software and startups, because the barriers to entry are super low, but chances of success are super high. But I always say I'd rather have a 1% chance than a 0% chance, and so that's probably the best answer I can give there.
I think that was some really great advice about true entrepreneurs are people who do something at a really young age of their life. So from Dave, so now I'm shifting more into like startups and like X and other topics. So what are some of your favorite startup pivot stories or experiences, maybe through your own startup journey or just through observing other startups? Like, what could you say about that?
In terms of my favorite pivots, Slack definitely comes to mind. That one, that was a wild one. They started as a video game. And Stuart Butterfield, he offered to give the money back to their investors. And they said no. They said, just figure something else out. And then out came Slack from that. I think that's probably the wildest one. Loom has a good one where they were originally a whiteboard app. And then through just consistent iteration and YouTube was a website for dating, so finding, you know, boyfriend or girlfriend. I thought that was really interesting. So, you know, you could almost argue that every startup is kind of a pivot where you essentially have an initial idea, and that idea you need to be flexible and listen to the market and iterate. And almost 99% of the time when you start a business, it's going to look a lot different than you thought it would 2 years later when you get things working, especially if you listen to the market and you apply the feedback. And I guess most importantly, you seek out that feedback. One personal example I have is a pivot. It's more in a business model. So at my first startup, Business Apps, we originally were cold calling small businesses. And for context, we helped, we built a platform that was a do-it-yourself, no-code mobile app builder for small businesses. And so we would cold call restaurants and say, like, hey, what's your mobile app strategy? And they'd say, app, like appetizer, do you want our menu? And so it was really hard to get through to customers. And then one day I saw a customer building apps for these large hotels in Europe. And so I called him, assuming I was like 22 at the time. And I assumed he owned the hotels. And then when I talked to him, he told me he was building apps on behalf of the hotels. So mobile apps for the hotels, because he made their website, managed their social media presence. And he had an agency that basically managed a bunch of different types of marketing services for them. And so I immediately asked him, how can I help you sell more apps? And so we switched our entire business model from selling direct to small businesses, which is really cost intensive. The sales cycle time is really long. And then also you got to sell one app at a time. And we went from selling one app at a time to selling, you know, 10, 20, 30, you know, prepackaged agreements. And then that's when the business kind of went like this all the way to just like that almost overnight. I think that month when we changed that business model and we created that offering, we tripled the business. And this is in like the infancy stages. I think we were at like 5,000 or 10,000 in monthly recurring revenue. And then we went to 200, 300,000 like that single month. Because what we didn't know was there's tens of thousands of other agencies with the exact same problem. So I think the lesson there is just listen to your customers, because they might have a use case that you just... I remember I had a Wikipedia white label. I was like, what is white label? He told me, like, if you could white label the platform, and I Googled it, and it means removing the other company's branding so they can put their own branding, so they can sell the mobile apps at any price that they see fit. So it's more of a solution that appears to be built by them, but you're just powering the technology.
I think you made a really interesting point about how customers are so key, but I also feel that, like, when you get customer feedback, you shouldn't take everything to heart, because they'll suggest so many features and it'll be so difficult to keep track of and keeping on building and building out new features and more features for your customers. So that's also like a downside, I guess you could say. And so my next question is more like, how did your first startup lead to your second one? Like, so now Acquired has achieved like a phenomenal amount of success. And I think with Business Apps, you had an acquisition or an exit. And so how did your learnings from your first startup lead you to creating the second one? And like, what was that kind of entrepreneurial itch, you could say, that led you to start Acquired?
Yeah, so for context, Business Apps ran the company for 8 years. Bootstrapped it to 10 million in recurring revenue, and then sold it to a private equity firm when I was 29. And then I didn't know what private equity was. I didn't have a deep understanding of how the businesses worked or what they look for when they acquire businesses. So we started optimizing the business to be acquired maybe a year prior or so. But what it really opened my eyes to was there's a lot of different private equity firms that specifically look to acquire bootstrap businesses. And so I thought, you know, hey, I had a great outcome. Why isn't there a place where I could just list my startup and then all the other private equity firms and other types of buyers can bid on my company? And so that was kind of an entrepreneurial itch, where it was really just me building a solution to address some of the challenges and problems and just confusion that I had when I was selling my first business. So the goal when I first started the business and our goal today is still just to make acquisitions more transparent and easier and more efficient for startup founders. Because as a startup founder, you most don't know anything about acquisitions, from how do you speak to buyers? How do you value your business? How do you prepare your startup when you're going to market? These are all things I had to learn on my own. And I just wish I had what we built at, you know, Acquire. So that's kind of the itch, was just that personal experience, understanding. Like, I remember there's kind of the light bulb moment went off when I sold the business, and then I had a countless amount of friends reaching out to me with the same questions, like, what's private equity? What is due diligence? How did they find you? Like, what? And so I thought, okay, I also didn't know these things. And like, does anyone know these things? And so, you know, just bringing more education around, you know, the most important part of the founder's journey, arguably, which is exit. I thought there was a big opportunity there, because there's endless books on marketing. There's endless books on how to find investors. I think there's like maybe less than 5 books on acquisition. So I just thought there was, you know, a good opportunity to really build something special for the startup ecosystem as a whole that just didn't exist. And I wish I had it. So.
So now my question to you. So how do you deal with competitors? So I saw on X that there was somebody that said that they had been around the business 2 years prior to when Acquired started. So, like, how do you guys deal with competitors and people stealing your ideas? Or, like, how do you deal with that as a founder?
Yeah, great question. So, Business Apps was cloned, even the bugs included, which is kind of funny. Like, there was 2 bugs that were cloned by 3 different companies. I could state them, but there's like, we would call the way we would identify certain apps within our database was app code. And if I could go back, I would change that to something like app ID. And so the whole industry used app code. And then the way our reseller program or white label program would work is we would give you app credits. And so everyone used that same terminology. If I could go back, I'd call it app licenses, meaning you have a partner account with us, you have 10 licenses to build 10 mobile apps on our platform. So, you know, being copied is part of just business. I don't take it personally at all. You know, I think it's good for the market, because what people also just don't understand is people don't copy bad products. And then second, every time, you know, you copy someone's product, they're going to refer over to the original product. It's very obvious. And so what ends up happening is more market education is happening, but you're not having to pay for any of the cost. And then sometimes you have a competitor that does something interesting, and then you end up copying them. So it's kind of just like a part of business. And I always say, if you're not being copied, try harder, because it's bound to happen if you come on to something that, you know, is interesting. No one copies a bad product.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight, that only the people that are being copied are the people who are already excelling in the business, who are already doing very well. And so now I wanted to pivot away, and I'm just really curious to hear your thoughts on, like, what are some of the most effective ways that you found, you know, getting your first 100 or like 1,000 users for Acquired or for like business apps? Like, what were some of those tips that you can distill down for some of the aspiring founders out there who might be looking to start their own businesses or like doing something in the startup space?
Sorry, say that one more time. You cut out for just a second. That last part, sorry.
So what are some of the most effective ways to gaining the first 100 or 1,000 users for a SaaS business or for like any kind of startup, and also from your own experience as the founder and CEO of Acquired and then Business Apps as well?
Great question. So There's many ways. I would say if you don't know how to do any sort of sales and marketing, just build in public. You know, create a journey that people want to follow. And there's a good saying on this, the best brand stories have no ending. So bringing people along can really help educate your customers and the market of what you're building, and then also help course correct in case you're going in the wrong direction. But for me personally, it's always been cold calling, cold email, cold calling, just talking to customers a lot. With business apps, I used to just live on live chat, and I would talk to every single user, that anyone that would talk to me, because I wanted to know what they hated about the product, what they loved about the product, but more importantly, I wanted to know what they hated. So I can only fix what people don't like. If they say it's great, I'm kind of like, okay, thanks. So I enjoy harsh feedback, because that really points me in the direction of, okay, how can we make this better? And so the same thing with the choir I sat on, live chat for more hours than I probably want to mention, and just lots of cold email, and just taking every single phone call I could get, hopping on any single podcast I can get. You know, those are the types of things I did in the early days. Just anyone who wanted to talk about the business with me, I would take that phone call. So some days I would talk to, and this is on top of operating the business, so the general operations of acquire, as an example. So taking the listings live, creating the newsletter, advertising them on social media. On top of that, I would still do customer support. I would take customer just feedback calls. So just in the early days, expect to talk to a lot and a lot and a lot of customers, and then talk to more. So that's kind of a short answer, and maybe not the most. There's no growth hacks. There's no magic bullet or, you know, trick. It's really just a process of talking to customers, taking in their feedback, distilling it down to what common themes that you're hearing, and then applying it in your business.
So what are your thoughts on building in public? So you mentioned a bit about like involving the customers and creating a journey that people want to follow. So there's like legends out there on X called like KP, who you already know, and some other people out there who are also doing building in public. So what are your thoughts on building in public for founders, and how does one kind of win at the content and brand building through building in public?
Yeah, I think it just allows you to get so much instant feedback about what you're doing, and then it also can help inspire other people, specifically if you're selling to startup founders, as an example. It's fun, in my opinion. You will get copied, though. That's definitely a theme I think I've seen a lot of people. But it's also a great way to build a personal brand. So what you're getting in return is, you know, you're building your brand, you're getting customers, you're building unfair distribution. And then you're also inspiring others that may not be your customers, but maybe, you know, adjacent customers, which could be, you know, hey, I'm not looking to sell my business, but I heard about this business because I like following them, or I like listening to their updates, or whatever it may be. So I actually didn't know building in public was like a thing or a term. I used to like post updates on Facebook when I was building business apps, like, oh, we were featured in TechCrunch or something like that. Or, oh, here's like a screenshot of the new navigation. I still have some. The only way I use Facebook now is for the memories feature. And so I'll see 10 years ago, like, oh, I was in Japan for some partnership thing. So I've always kind of, you know, I've always been just one to share what I'm working on. And then I found Twitter, and then I started doing that there. And then I found out, oh, there's like a whole like community of people that do this. So I kind of unintentionally, started building in public, but I think it's a great way to build trust with your audience, find customers, get feedback. Like right now I can just ask, you know, hey, what does everyone think about this feature? And then you know, I can get a ton of feedback, you know, really, really quickly. So I think there's a lot of benefits to it, but, you know, it does take work. So if you're going to do it in terms of, you know, building in public, you know, it's only effective if you're consistent with it. And this really just applies maybe as a whole to thinking about social media is only do it if you enjoy it, because if you don't enjoy it, you won't be consistent. And if you're not consistent, it's not going to work.
Yeah, that was some really good advice. And I love how, like, even before you got a chance to, like, know about building in public, you were already doing that stuff on Facebook and, like, you were trying to build your personal brand and get instant feedback on what you were doing. So my next question, and just to wrap this up, like, just to hit this home. So Artificiary, he asked a question on brand building. So I'm just curious for me and the audience to know, like, how do you come up with your content for X? Like, you're always posting, like, on a daily basis. I see you're posting. And so how do you come up with that content for the X? And how do you win at content and brand building? And if you're just starting today, what tips do you have for somebody that's looking to kind of expand their X following or just become more, a more known person in the industry?
So for me personally, I've had a lot of people ask me this, like how do you write the, I just write it from my phone. I wake up, I drink coffee. I like writing. And so I'll just write stuff in the morning. And that's typically my whole Twitter strategy. And it's not like sometimes there'll be other tweets. You know, if we have like a screenshot of someone who sold their business on like a billboard, that's obviously planned. But most of the time I'm just writing it from my phone, and I'll have maybe like a few drafts as just ideas, but I don't have like scheduled tweets or, you know, it's very, I guess I just try to be myself, you know, and I like to say, sometimes they're just reminders for me, like, hey, over communicate everything with your team, because, you know, they can't read your mind. Like, I'll say stuff like that. But to answer your question in terms of, you know, if you're just starting out on Twitter, I think the main thing you want to do is be different, be yourself. Don't look, I think where people go awry in terms of a social media strategy is they try really hard. And so what I mean by that is they look at other tweets, they copy other people's styles, and they don't have an authentic voice. I think one thing that you'll notice across all quote big Twitter accounts is they have unique perspectives, they have opinions, and they share them, or they're doing something really interesting and they do it consistently. So one idea could be to write down your brand voice. Like if I was to write down my brand voice, I think it would be, you know, helpful, humorous, motivating, educational, top of mind, something like that. And then just stay within that circle. So every time you think of something to tweet, just look at your brand voice. So it's always consistent. So people, you know, if your name is blurred out, they can say, oh, that's from this person. That's probably my best initial tip. But when you're first starting, I've heard commenting on other people's posts works really well. I don't do that too often. If I ever comment, it's just like, congrats, like, I'm rooting for you. I don't usually have like, hey, I have a question here or something like that. But that can also work too if you're just starting, in terms of just, because I'll follow people that engage with me where they ask me questions and they're good questions and I'll respond to them. So that can be a good strategy as well. But I think it really just comes down to, you know, just remembering, like, there was a time where everyone had zero followers, like everyone had 1,000 followers. And then if you're consistent with it, I've seen a lot of Twitter growth graphs and they almost all have just one thing in common. And it's not like a big up line and then flat up and then flat. It's just like a very slow straight line. And so consistency really is the name of the game. And so you just got to be consistent. And then over time, you start to find, you know, kind of the style of writing that works for you and that your audience likes. But the key, I think, is be yourself. You know, don't be someone just post stuff that, you know, other people have posted that is similar, but they got a lot of likes. And then you're just kind of looking at what people post because you don't know what to write. Just be yourself. That's probably not the most like actionable advice, but that's how I like to think about it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you do really well on X is you're just so authentic and you're always like rooting for people and always like a champion for the community. And that's why people are so inspired by you and they're so like wanting to follow your journey even more. And that's what I think the audience can take away is just to be authentic, just to be different, be yourself, as you said. And yeah. So it was an absolute honor and a pleasure to host you on the podcast today. And do share like how the audience can get in touch with you and how they can learn more about what the amazing work that Acquired is doing.
Yeah. So if you want to know more about just like my personal story, I actually wrote a book. It's called Getting Acquired. It's on Amazon. It talks about it just my whole story from like how I got the idea to how I built it. Because I'm not technical, I didn't have any experience. I was in college, and I kept a journal, and I turned all those journal entries into a book. I haven't made any money on it, so it's I just wrote it to, again, inspire entrepreneurs. So if you want to learn more on that level, that's available. And just follow me on Twitter, X. That rebrand is throwing me off. Aguesdecky, if you can spell it right. Or if you're looking to, you know, buy or sell a startup, just acquire.com.
So if you're listening to this podcast right now, I have an open opportunity to reach this audience. So if you want to reach college students and freshers interested in startups and venture capital, and just in terms of the demographics, the age of 18 to 22 is the highest age demographic in India, and US are the two largest country demographics of listeners for this podcast. Email me at bizpodruhi@gmail.com. So thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode and hope you've learned something new.